Welcome to the Making Sense Podcast. This is Sam Harris. Okay, a little housekeeping here. How shall I put this? Well, for those of you who heard my previous episode with Rory Stewart, this might come as a bit of a surprise. I thought that was a great conversation, as did many of you, as did really everyone, as far as I can tell. I'll remind you, Rory is a fascinating person who spent something like 20 months walking across the Middle East and wrote a book about his travels in Afghanistan in particular. He has wide experience in the Muslim world, served in Iraq for the British civil service. And we talked about many things in this podcast and touched on my concerns about jihadism fairly briefly. We spoke for about an hour and 20 minutes, and maybe it was 20 minutes of that conversation that we focused on jihadism. The general focus was on just the failures of nation building in Afghanistan and Iraq and the unraveling of the rules-based international order. We spoke about Brexit and how odious partisan politics have become. There were many other topics. And what was notable is that we basically agreed about everything except we had a clear difference of emphasis. I tend to emphasize the ideological origins of certain types of violence. I'm very concerned about extreme religious beliefs and how they're motivating. And yet, of course, I acknowledge that there are other sources of human conflict: tribalism, nationalism, sociopathy, etc. And in the context of our conversation, Rory was emphasizing the importance of nationalism, which he thinks is a bigger variable, even in the history of our conflicts in the Muslim world. Now, that is certainly debatable, but in our conversation, he wasn't denying the importance of religious ideology, and I wasn't denying the importance of nationalism. If we were disagreeing at all, it was simply a matter of how much we weighted each of those variables. So anyway, I thought it was a great conversation, but someone surfaced some remarks that Rory made on his own podcast later that week. Rory is speaking here with Humza Yousaf, who is a Muslim Scottish politician who served as First Minister of Scotland and the leader of the Scottish National Party. And I'm otherwise unfamiliar with Humza, but you'll hear some of his remarks for context.
One of the things that I've noticed recently, particularly since October the 7th, is an increase in people making stereotypical comments about Muslims. I mean, I just did an interview with an American podcast, a guy called Sam Harris, who was hammering me for nearly an hour saying, yes, but surely, Rory, you have to admit there's a connection between Muslims and suicide bombers and Muslims and terrorists. He just wouldn't let it go. And I wondered, is that something that you've experienced? And is it something that's getting better, getting worse? How does our society deal with it?
I think it's getting worse. Well, maybe it comes in cycles. But I remember, for me, 9/11 was such a seminal moment for me, and that might sound a bit kind of selfish, given I was thousands of miles away and affected and killed so many thousands of Americans. But for me, it was a day I'll always remember. I mean, 9/11 took place on a Tuesday, I think, and coming back from school and school bus home, you know, radio was on, you can kind of hear what was going on, and the driver was telling us to shut up because he was trying to listen to what was going on. And I went home and saw all the scenes, as you guys would have seen, the terrible, tragic and terror attack that took place. And then the next day, I remember going to school and sitting in form class, and, you know, the same two guys I used to sit beside every single morning, and we'd talk about the things that teenage boys talk about, mainly in my case, Celtic, you know, a football club I loved. And they were bombarding me, not with any maliciousness, just bombarding me with questions that I had no idea the answer to. You know, why do Muslims hate America? Do you know who was behind it? What was it all about? I'm sitting there going, I don't have a clue, right? And so for me, and then of course, all the Islamophobia that followed post 9/11. But I have to say, my position as First Minister, and even perhaps before then, there is definitely still a deep-rooted, systemic and endemic Islamophobia in this country. And Scotland is absolutely not immune to that.
What is really disappointing about this is that there's really no way around the fact that Rory is painting me as a bigot here, or at least somebody who's politics and ethics are compromised by a lack of understanding about what's really going on in the Muslim world. I don't think I'm being especially thin-skinned to perceive this as defamatory in some sense. One of the reasons why I bring this up is that I looked on Reddit where this got surfaced, and many people are now speculating that our conversation must have gone on for much longer than is indicated by the audio that I aired, right? I must have been badgering him for quite some time and then presented an abbreviated version of our conversation. That's not what happened at all. So you listen to our conversation, you are hearing every word we spoke to one another, with the exception of possibly some sidebar conversation about, you know, setting up our microphones or something that would cut from every interview. Anyway, I've since reached out to Rory, and he was quite gracious and, I think, embarrassed. He's agreed to come back on the podcast and do a post-mortem on this. I'm pretty sure I know what happened here, and I'm reasonably confident we can have a conversation that will be useful and, who knows, maybe even fun. So you can look for that in the coming weeks. As for other misunderstandings and misrepresentations that seem very unlikely to be rectified through conversation, someone pointed out another one of those to me this week. Apparently, my former friend Elon Musk is bashing me again on the social media platform that he owns, X, and on the basis of yet another clip of a podcast appearance of mine that has been produced by yet another right-wing troll. This is what seems to happen every time now. I go on someone else's podcast. People look for clips that can be exported from that appearance that are misleading as to what I believe and what I was saying in context. Sometimes, as in this case, it's pretty clear the clip isn't even saying what they claim it is, but they have titled their post something profoundly misleading. In any case, there was a clip from my appearance on the David Pakman show where I seemed to be talking about the crisis at the southern border of the U.S. and worrying that someone like Tucker Carlson could exaggerate the gravity of the problem and thereby undermine Biden's chances of being reelected. And the whole thing got framed as me being skeptical that there was even a problem at the southern border. Of course, the chaos there is now a major concern of everyone right of center and many of us left of center. So Elon's response to this clip in front of millions of people was that Sam Harris's mind has turned to goo. Now, the irony here is that I think Elon and I have exactly the same view of the southern border. I view it as a political and social emergency and a scandal. And I have long been concerned that this is the issue that will deliver us a second Trump presidency. So I am not at all inclined to minimize the significance of the problem there. However, in this case, I'm actually grateful for this instance of misrepresentation because it has finally convinced me that I can no longer care about this sort of thing. It's now so clear that social media has become a hallucination machine. There's no way to prevent this. No one is taking the time to find out what was really said in context. There's just nothing to respond to here. So I suppose this is an epiphany I could have had and perhaps should have had many years ago, because I've been complaining for 20 years about people misrepresenting my views, even before the advent of social media. It's a thing that has driven me most crazy, really. But in this case, the misrepresentation is so ridiculous because, again, Elon and I actually agree about what's happening at the southern border that something has snapped for me, and I just simply can't care about this anymore. It's quite a relief. So my pledge to you and to myself is that I'm not going to complain about this anymore. I'm not going to notice this sort of thing anymore. And the truth is, I think this epiphany should extend to what just happened with Rory as well, right? I mean, the reason for me to do a podcast with Rory about this is I think his confusion here is so well subscribed, and he is or should be so knowledgeable about the terrain here, right? I mean, this is somebody who knows much more about the Muslim world in many respects than I do. There's no question about that. So I just didn't want to leave it untouched, because if there's any possibility of someone revealing my ignorance about anything relevant here, surely it's somebody like Rory who could do that. And given how much I have focused on Islam in the past, and given how culpable I feel it is for so many of the world's problems, it would seem irresponsible for me not to revisit this topic with Rory. But in general, I think even there, I should forget about misrepresentations and misunderstandings. We are now just careening into a world of deep fakes and the most malignant distortions of everyone's public persona. So now I think I should just reconcile myself to the idea that anyone who cares about what I think will listen to what I say in one of my own channels at some appropriate length. And beyond that, there's nothing I can do. In fact, another example just crossed my desk, and this proves that there's basically nothing I can do to successfully take other people's feet out of my mouth. I saw a clip of Constantin Kissin and Tom Bilyeu in conversation on Tom's podcast about me, and they were talking about my cancellation, effectively, on the right, and my views about Trump and COVID. And the amazing thing is, I've been on both of their podcasts largely for the purpose of clarifying my views about Trump and COVID. And both of them are totally confused about what I think on both of those topics. I mean, these are both very smart guys who are clearly well disposed toward me. I like them and they like me, and they're still completely confused about what I think on these two topics. And I have spent hours on each of their podcasts clarifying what I think. It is fucking hopeless. I'm embarrassed that it has taken me this long to realize it, but I mean, this is now my new religion. I simply cannot care what other people think I think. I just have to put my stuff out there and move on. And that's what I will be doing on this podcast. Okay. And now for today's podcast. Today I'm speaking with Coleman Hughes. Coleman is a writer and podcast host and musician. He's written for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, National Review, Quillette, The Spectator, City Journal, and elsewhere. He's currently a contributing writer at the Free Press and an analyst for CNN. He also has a Substack newsletter titled Coleman's Corner and a podcast, Conversations with Coleman, and most relevantly, a new book, The End of Race Politics, Arguments for a Colorblind America. And that is the topic of today's conversation. We talk about race and racism. We discuss the ideal of colorblindness and what that means. Race and crime. Coleman's experience at TED, which you heard me discuss previously with Chris Anderson. The concept of Latinx. The confusion of the elites. Ibram X. Kendi. Affirmative action. Class differences. Poverty. Single-parent families. The death of George Floyd and the trial of Derek Chauvin, Candace Owens, Christopher Rufo, guilt by association, John McWhorter, Glenn Lowry, reparations for slavery and Jim Crow, the difference between various immigrant communities, evidence of discrimination, the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., and other topics. As always, it was great to speak with Coleman, and now I bring you Coleman Hughes. I am here with Coleman Hughes. Coleman, thanks for joining me again.
Great to be on again.
So you have a new book The End of Race Politics, Arguments for a Colorblind America. And I must sheepishly confess that I have not read your book, though I appear to have blurbed it. Just for the record here, I had to declare blurb bankruptcy some years ago, and so I don't blurb books anymore, but occasionally I can blurb the writer of that book, which is what I did in your case. But normally I would have read the book before we do a podcast, but I didn't get a physical copy. I blame no one for this but the universe, and I know you sent me a PDF, but I spend so much time in front of screens, I just cannot read a book as a PDF. So the advantage to this is that there is a silver lining. We can really take it from the top, and you can roll out your argument for a naive listener, which I'll pretend to be, because you and I have talked about these issues before, and obviously we've thought a lot about them. But every listener to this podcast knows that I am a huge Coleman Hughes fan. I've made no secret of that. And I think in my blurb for the book, I say something about, it's like you're a person from the future. You're the person who's come back from the future and borne witness to what a sane future with respect to the variable of race actually looks like. And that's always how you've seemed to me. So let's just jump in. What is your basic argument in the book?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for breaking your rule on blurbs for me. I'm honored. And, you know, in any event, a book is really just an occasion to talk about the topic in many ways. So yeah, my basic argument in this book is we have this idea of colorblindness with respect to race, which I define as treating people without regard to race, really making your best effort to treat the individuals in your lives without regard to their race when it matters, and to get race as a category out of public policy, to get rid of public policies that use race as a factor in determining how to distribute goods, services, aid, and so forth. And it's the second half of that is more controversial for people than the first half. And the reason this idea needs rescuing at all, because it was once the consensus view of American liberals, at least there was a brief moment in the 60s on the ringing rhetoric of Martin Luther King and the spirit of the civil rights movement, where, you know, enough people that mattered came together and agreed that colorblindness was the goal. And so many people agreed on it at that point that you even had a book like Black Power, which was the manifesto of the movement by the same name in the late 60s, even acknowledged as a caveat that colorblindness was the ultimate goal worth pursuing, and just disagreed on how we get there.
Mm.
In the intervening years, you've seen more and more people actually just abandon colorblindness even as an ultimate goal, to the point where when I set out to do research for this book, just as a test, I Googled colorblindness race so as to distinguish it from the visual condition. And 9 out of 10 articles I got were articles telling me why colorblindness is wrong. It's, in the worst case, a Trojan horse for white supremacy, or in the best case, naive. And the 10th article was a Wikipedia page. So something has happened in 50 years where the view that colorblindness is wrong and evil, which used to be confined to critical race theory, has become sort of the norm on the left. And to be fair, I think proponents of the idea of colorblindness have made themselves an easy target with the phrase, quote, "I don't see color," which is a really common refrain and a common point of mockery among the critics of colorblindness, because it's obviously not true. We do see color. We all see color. And at a deeper level, we, at least adults, we all see color. I think, you know, there are actually kids or people from other cultures can be something close to colorblind in the ways that matter. But most American adults are not colorblind. When I walk into a room, you notice that I'm not white. When you, Sam, walk into a room, people notice that you are. What's more, we are all probably capable of racial bias. Clever psychologists can put us in experiments and, you know, show us in some cases to be racially biased. And in situations where race strongly correlates with something that matters, I think almost all of us are capable of racial bias. So that's not what I mean when I say colorblindness, and I don't think it's what people should mean when they say colorblindness. So I think we should abandon this misleading phrase that's too easy of a target, we don't see color, and instead say what we mean, which is, I try my best to treat people without regard to race in my personal life, and I think race should be left out of public policy. That's the basic thesis of the book.
Yeah, well, maybe we can cycle on that last point again, because I think it's interesting psychologically and ethically, because I'm definitely guilty of saying something close to I don't see color, or that I aspire to not see color, or something like that, or I think we shouldn't see color. But it's not a matter of seeing so much as it is caring about, right? It's like the analogy I keep using, to the consternation of many of my progressive critics, is to hair color or to eye color. Now, of course, I see hair color and I see eye color, but they're not politically or ethically salient really ever, right? So I simply don't care how many blondes did or didn't get into Harvard this year. And I don't think we as a society should care. And the only reason why we would care is if we had a history of discrimination against blonde people and we were tracking that because there was some historical injustice that we felt we need to rectify. And of course, that is the case with skin color. But when I imagine a truly sane future, which you appear to inhabit for me, I imagine a future where skin color has become like hair color or eye color, which is to say that it's an obvious surface feature around which people differ, but those differences simply don't matter. And even if we celebrate them, they don't matter. I mean, there are people who have especially beautiful hair or eyes, and the color is part of that. And we might even talk about how amazing, their hair and eyes look. And you can say the same thing for a person's skin, right? I mean, there are people who have just astonishing skin, black or white or other. And it could be the actual topic of conversation, but it has no political or ethical weight, and it would be insane to think that it should. And so that's the colorblindness I would advocate is something around that, by analogy to hair color and eye color. Is there anything about that that strikes you as wrong?
So you gave a caveat that unless we had a history of discrimination against a particular group of people, I think that I have the same caveat in my book, and we can talk about sort of what my vision for addressing that looks like. So I would echo that caveat, and I would add one more. Unlike the case in eye color or hair color, there are cultural differences that track racial groups. We live in a multicultural society, a multicultural country, which if anything means that there are multiple cultures. So I would consider Black Americans, for example, to be a subculture of Americans, which are a broader culture. And in my effort and desire to be colorblind, right, to support colorblindness, both at the level of public policy and in my personal life, I don't think that that requires me to be culture blind in the sense that, say, you are a Black person that's grown up your whole life very attached to Black culture, you love the food that Black people cook. Mm-hmm. You love the movies that Black people make. You love the music that comes culturally from Black Americans. And you have a special attachment to it that you don't quite have to every other culture, that you don't have to, say, Serbian culture. Am I telling you that you can't feel that attachment, or that you can't even preferentially consume and be among the culture that is familiar to you? Absolutely not. And that's not what I mean by colorblindness. What I picture is kind of a firewall between that kind of cultural affinity and our conversations about public policy and ethics and right and wrong. When we're talking about right and wrong, improving human flourishing, crafting public policy, one leaves those things to the extent you can at the door. And I say that because it's a common objection to the colorblindness argument.
Hmm. Yeah, I would echo that. I mean, I have a special attachment to Indian culture, for instance. Mm. I'm a huge fan of it, notwithstanding all the insanity that one can find in India. But you know, it's my favorite food. It's among my favorite music. It's just, I've spent a fair amount of time there. I love so much about it. And I would never assume anyone, much less Indians, should give that up, right? So it's that part of the diversity assertion that diversity makes everything better is, I fully agree with. I want great Indian restaurants in every city in America, and I rely on Indian immigrants to provide those restaurants for the most part. And so it is with so much else we all love to one or another degree about cultural difference. So yeah, so color blindness of the sort that we're indicating by shorthand with that phrase can fully embrace a kind of xenophile relationship to cultural diversity. I mean, it's a little bit like where this tips over into identity politics, I think, can be understood by analogy to what it is to be a sports fan. There are a lot of people who really love sports. They become huge fans of one team or one athlete or another. And all of that is incredibly fun and amusing and improves life until it tips over into a kind of fanaticism that is really toxic. So toxic that you have, you know, soccer players who, in the worst case, commit an own goal in a big match, and they wind up getting murdered by their fans back in, you know, Latin America or somewhere that really cares too much about that particular sport. It's hard to specify with a bright line, but there is clearly a line between the fun of diversity and the still caring about difference that adds spice to life, and tipping over into political factionalism that is obviously distorting our politics and making it morally unworkable. So I don't know if you like that analogy or not, but that's another shortcut I have in thinking about this issue.
No, I actually, in my book, I think, rather in my book, I talk a little bit about sports too. There is a difference between two close friends making racial jokes about one another that both find funny but neither take seriously. And on the other hand, two people, you know, coming to blows in a conversation because people of your race could never understand me. Right? Those are both instances of quote unquote caring about race in the abstract, but we know the difference between them when we see them. One is actually a healthy expression, a kind of release valve for the racial differences we all notice. And one, as your analogy says, it carries what can be benign to an unhealthy extreme. Now, in my book, I talk about a similar racial analogy when I bring up this video that Morgan Freeman famously participated in with Mike Wallace. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that you've seen it. I'm sure many people have seen it.
Yeah.
Where, you know, Morgan Freeman essentially says, look, this is how we're going to get past race. I'm going to stop calling you a white man, and I'm going to ask you to stop calling me a black man. I'm going to call you Mike, and you're going to call me Morgan. And it's a very powerful interview, if you haven't seen it. But what it puts forth is kind of a testable hypothesis in a way. If we want fewer and fewer racist thoughts and feelings and toxic race-based thoughts and feelings to abound in our society, should we talk about race more and more, or should we talk about race less and less? And by analogy, I imagine that, say, for whatever reason, we have a goal of reducing the amount of animosity between New York Yankee fans and Boston Red Sox fans, which is a very tall task. Let's say for whatever reason we want to accomplish this. Would the thing to do be to raise people from age zero to care about baseball as much as possible, right? Let's say we educate every child about the rules of baseball in kindergarten. We substitute every exercise in gym that used to be, say, dodgeball or kickball, and we make it baseball every time. And we just crank up to 12 the amount that people know about and care about baseball. Would this have the effect of amplifying the amount of animosity between New York fans and Boston fans, or would it tamp down on it because everyone is so educated about baseball? It's at least not obvious to me, is what I'm saying. It's not obvious to me that the way towards better race relations between races of people is to raise the salience of racial identity from as young an age as possible. And this has been the implicit and at times explicit belief of progressive race ideas. I'm thinking of Robin DiAngelo, her book White Fragility. I'm thinking of just this past week, the San Francisco Chronicle reported that a school in San Francisco has been paying an organization called Woke Kindergarten to come into a school of mostly Spanish-speaking kids and teach them about white supremacy as their math and reading scores have declined.
Hmm.
So it's not obvious to me that Morgan Freeman is wrong in that we should dial down our somewhat obsessive talk about racial identity and sort of confine it to the real racism. I have no problem and am strongly in favor of talking about real racism that exists. And I give examples in my book. But I think a lot of what we end up talking about when we talk about race are either fake examples of racism or just kind of toxic race-based discussion that sort of stereotypes whole groups of people and does not deal with actual examples of racism.
Yeah, well, I want to get into some of those issues and the difference between race and class and how we should think about dealing with inequality in our society, even inequality that is highly correlated with race still. But what about those cases, just to close the loop on colorblindness as a goal, what about the inconvenient cases where one's awareness of racial difference is made all too rational because of different, you know, base rate effects with respect to crime and other variables, right? So there are definitely situations where a person's race is a relevant piece of information in judging whether or not something anomalous and potentially dangerous is likely to happen, right? I mean, this is it lands one way when you have a white guy like me saying it. It landed differently when Jesse Jackson, I don't know when this might have been in the 90s, somewhere around the peak of crime in America, he said, you know what, I forget what context he was in, but he said to some audience, I'll tell you what I'm sick of. I'm sick of, you know, walking down the street at night, hearing footsteps behind me, turning and seeing that it's a white guy and feeling relief, right? And that was an all too honest confession of a fairly horrific disparity in the rate of crime in the black versus white community. And if in case people are not in touch with these statistics, this is still true, although in the 90s this was worse. And most of this crime is, you know, most crime is intra-racial. I mean, most black people are victimized by other black people. Most white people are victimized by other white people. There's some differences there that are worth talking about. But still, it's mostly a matter of, I mean, crime in the black community is mostly black-on-black crime, and it certainly was then. What do you do with the inconvenient fact that it is in fact true that in certain situations, just you see black people in a place where you know there are not that many black people living, and you know that most crime in that, you know, now I'm not talking about violent crime so much as other crime, you know that most crime is in fact committed by black people in those in that part of the city. It suddenly becomes relevant that you're seeing four black guys in a car driving on a street they almost certainly don't live on. And this is true in many major cities in America. And it's relevant for the police eye view of that situation, right? And this is profiling by another name. And conversely, it would be relevant to see, you know, four white guys with shaved heads in a parking lot outside a black church, right? Like you'd immediately wonder, what are those guys doing here? And you wouldn't be insane to wonder that, given the pattern of criminality we know exists in certain contexts. So I give you that none too softball to deal with.
Yeah, so
take my feet out of my mouth.
Okay. So look, I've lived in New York City for 9 years now, and I've lived in many different neighborhoods, some less nice than others. I check the NYPD statistics as a matter of professional responsibility and someone who thinks and talks about these issues. And I also I ride the subway, I have eyes. Like I said, a commitment to colorblindness doesn't mean that I don't see race. It doesn't mean I don't notice patterns. And when there are patterns as strong as some of the racial crime patterns are in many American cities, it is inevitable that your brain is going to recognize those patterns whether or not you want it to. Now, some people are more or less honest about this. I think you've chosen the path of being honest about this in line with your overall position on lying. Other people choose the path of denying the facts, which is understandable given how uncomfortable the facts are. And then a third group of people takes the route of focusing monomaniacally on those facts and posting nothing but videos of Black people committing crime, you know, on Twitter. That latter path, I think, is toxic and needlessly divisive. The path of simply not talking about it, while it might be right at Thanksgiving dinner, I don't think that it's right as a general orientation for our public conversation about race. I think that journalists have to be able to look at facts. So in New York City, basically the entire time that I've lived here, it has been the case that over 90% of shootings are committed by Blacks and Hispanics. 95% in some years. So what is it like to be a New York City cop that responds to these shootings? By the way, the majority of such cops are themselves of color. What that experience is like is, if it isn't clear from the first month of your being a New York City cop, it is clear by the first 3 or 4 months that almost every time you get a call about a shooting, a 911 call, you'll make money all day betting that the person was not white or not Asian. That is an impossible fact not to notice, even for someone as committed to the end goal of colorblindness as one could possibly be. Now, I don't view that as refuting the goal of colorblindness in general. I view that as having two implications. One is it shows you how wrong things have to go for the general rule of thumb of colorblindness to be violated. You really have to be in situations that where violence and life and death and, you know, catching felons, where the stakes are that high, as opposed to, say, meeting a friend of a friend for the first time in a coffee shop, which is how most of us, you know, most of us, I think, listening to this are lucky enough to live most of our lives in lower stakes situations where there's no need to violate the principle of colorblindness. And then secondly, it impresses upon me the urgency of actually addressing crime and getting crime under control, of not letting crime spike. I can tell you every single Black person I know that lived in New York City in the 80s or 90s says that as a Black man in that time, you couldn't catch a cab. But nowadays, it's gotten better. The other thing everyone who's lived in New York City says is that crime was terrible in the 90s. Everyone got mugged and carried muggers' money around. And then Giuliani came and it just all went away. My strong suspicion is that those two things are not correlated. In other words, if we care about reducing racism against Black people, there is almost no better way to do that than to actually address crime. Because when crime comes down, the proverbial cab driver and cop and so forth, who are in those high-stakes situations where they can't help but discriminate, there will be less of an urge for them to do that. So, you know, the hard example here just impresses upon me not the fact that colorblindness should be jettisoned, but the fact that A, we should really pay attention to crime as a component of fighting racism. And impresses upon me how high the stakes have to be in order for us to jettison it in the first place.
Well, finally, on the topic of colorblindness, I mean, I know you on your own podcast and elsewhere have done a fairly full postmortem on your experience at TED, where you gave a talk on the topic of colorblindness and received a fair amount of pushback. And I think you probably heard my conversation with Chris Anderson about that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how much you want to be debriefed on your experience here. I mean, we can touch it as fully or as superficially as you want. But, you know, I didn't go so deep with Chris, apart from just exposing what seemed to me to be the core of the issue, which I mean, he more or less admitted, which I mean, he said it was a fairly amazing disclosure. I mean, he didn't seem to treat it with the astonishment that I think it deserves, which is that when he admitted that you could never have been invited to TED just a few short years ago, right? Which is tantamount to saying that, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. could not have given a TED talk a few years ago, given the level of, you know, ideological capture of the organization or along the lines of that we're talking about. Feel free to say anything you want about your experience or my conversation with Chris, but that, you know, you were talking to, you know, a very high status audience about the virtues of maintaining colorblindness as the goal of our racial politics. Mm-hmm. And it provoked a fairly hysterical response, which was, I really, in my view, pathological on its face. It doesn't testify to a mere difference of opinion on these issues. It testifies to a kind of brokenness of certain people and a certain cultural attitude, which is, you know, as I think I told Chris, I mean, you gave one of the most anodyne talks imaginable, not anodyne as in boring, but just anodyne as in non-threatening, given its, your thesis. And yet people perceived it to have really precipitated a kind of moral emergency, you know, in the room when you gave it. So that's...
Yeah. Yeah, so if people want the detailed version, they can read my account of it at the Free Press. I'll just make a few comments. One, yeah, I agree with you. It was anodyne and it was non-threatening and I was non-threatening and I was friendly to people the whole week and I actually literally, you know, had a conversation and hugged it out with one of the people that was upset with the TED Talk afterward because I just... For whatever reason, I have a lot of patience for people that are emotionally upset by what I say. And so I was willing to go every extra mile to get people to understand that I wasn't, quote unquote, attacking their existence. But there were some people at TED, a very small minority, it should be said, that have the philosophy of safetyism, wherein what I was saying wasn't just something they strongly disagreed with, it made them feel quote unquote unsafe. And once something makes you feel unsafe, then, you know, I have to be removed essentially, right? It's a very powerful bargaining tactic if you're an employee, because then there's like implications for hostile workplace environment and things like that. When really all I did was, you know, gently give my perspective that, you know, 98% of the people in the room, you know, it went down pretty smooth with them. People of all colors, by the way, you know, people were coming up to me afterwards, not just white people as the stereotype you might think, but black people, Hispanic people, and so forth.
But just to give that, just to remind people of the context here, it is pretty amazing for Chris to have told me that you could not have been invited a couple of years prior. You know, his perception of the organization and perhaps his misperception of his audience suggested to him that you were an edgy speaker and really all you were arguing for was, you know, as you said at the top here, what was the consensus, the moral consensus view during the civil rights movement?
Yes, that's true. I mean, right down to Martin Luther King's recommendation in his book, Why We Can't Wait, for a broad class-based anti-poverty program that would benefit the black and white poor alike. So I was really just giving a pretty straightforward Martin Luther King updated for the 21st century. It was nothing new, nothing original, just something I feel passionate about and I think people have forgotten. And when I agree with him, I actually take it for granted as almost obvious that I couldn't have given that talk 2 years ago, for instance, because the so-called racial reckoning around the summer of 2020 and its aftermath was still reverberating too strongly through elite institutions. I would have been received as just, you know, even further outside the realm of acceptable opinion. But, you know, I think this underscores the huge difference between the elite and the non-elite in general. I think most non-elites that listen to that TED talk, I appreciate you saying it's not boring, but I think many would have found it boring because
it's common sense.
It's common sense. That's right. And it's only not common sense to the kinds of people that think Latinx is what Hispanic people want to be called. And I use that example. I should flesh it out a little bit more because it encapsulates the divide between the elite and the non-elite better than any other single issue, I think. I'm half Puerto Rican and grew up spending a lot of time with the Puerto Rican half of my family, many of whom didn't speak English in the older generation. And so when around 2014 and 2015, I got to college and people, I started seeing this term Latinx. It was very bizarre because I'd never heard it before. And I figured having grown up constantly around my Puerto Rican family members, I'd have heard of it if it were in use. And then secondly, it just seemed like a bizarre anglicization because Spanish doesn't actually operate in a way that makes a word like Latinx even make sense theoretically. Mm. So when people started using it at Columbia, most of whom had no Hispanic family, this struck me as very odd intuitively, because in that particular case, I was fairly in touch with how a working class Hispanic person would speak. Now, when Pew finally did research on this and found that some 96%, 95 or 6%, if memory serves, of Hispanic people either had never heard of the word or didn't like it, that struck me as intuitively obvious. Now, Latinx is an issue because I happen to have that background. I happen to have intuitions that were more in line with reality. But in most other ways, I could be as clueless and elite as anyone. I grew up upper middle class. I went from a very nice public school to a very nice private school to Juilliard and then Columbia University. I'm as elite virtually as anyone could be on most issues. And to sit back and reflect on how thick the bubble of eliteness can be, it's like you can pierce it 20 times and it can still have an effect in terms of just the difference between the norms and culture of elites and the norms and culture of everyone else. Hmm. And the TED example is just another example of that. What I said is only controversial to a group of people who have really, I think, forgotten or don't work hard enough to understand how unique and elite their set of values are.
Well, I mean, I should just say, if it wasn't obvious it was certainly obvious in my conversation with Chris, but I should make it obvious here. I really greatly admire Chris, but I've always viewed him as a kind of canary in the coal mine for these kinds of issues. I mean, I think I told him I viewed him as someone who was a bit of a hostage of his organization and, you know, suffering from, by turns, you know, Stockholm syndrome or, you know, some other condition where he can't quite recognize how aberrant the elites have become on certain issues. And, you know, I say this as someone who considers himself embedded very much in that same bubble, you know, with you and Chris and the very people who are reacting, who were reacting badly to your talk. And I've run into this issue with Chris around issues of, you know, around radical Islam and the allegations of Islamophobia, et cetera. And so we've gone around that track a bunch. And I just think we have to be honest about what's really happening in the world and honest about how clear the ethical and political goals are or should be. And I think, I mean, here's a landmark we really shouldn't lose sight of. And yet certain people are working to guide us in a very different direction. I mean, the landmark is as MLK had it and as you have dusted it off, getting to a world where superficial differences simply don't matter and we care about the content of a person's character not the color of their skin, to use MLK's line. That just seems so obviously good. And yet many people are arguing, that, explicitly arguing, that that's a false goal. It's not just that there's a different way to reach that goal. I do take it as prima facie absurd to think that we're going to care more and more about race as a way of caring less and less about it, as you pointed out. But, you know, we have a few characters who are quite celebrated in elitist circles at places like TED or at the Aspen Ideas Festival. And I think none has been as damaging to the conversation from my point of view as Ibram X. Kendi. I know you have offered to debate him. Has he ever responded to those offers to debate?
No, he hasn't. He said in a few of his lectures that I've misrepresented his views, and so a debate between us would be him constantly sort of correcting my straw man. But to my knowledge, he's never given an example of me misrepresenting his views, and I would hope a debate would be a great forum for him to make clear what my misrepresentation alleged.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I just want to pick up a little bit on what you said about Chris too, and I want to make that clear too, because I like Chris. I continue to like Chris. I think he is in a tough position, it seems, maybe straddling between values he seems to share with me and the reality of his employees' feelings.
Mm.
Not sure how I would navigate that, and I'm not in charge of a big organization like that. Frankly, I think that my TED debacle unleashed a wave of repressed anger at TED among people that, you know, used to love TED, but for one or another reason, because of some aspect of woke capture, either don't go to TED anymore or just don't like it anymore. And I think my debacle became like released pent up anger of years.
Mm.
And I think that was quite unpleasant, but it can also be an opportunity for him to course correct. And I know he's invited Barry Weiss and Bill Ackman.
Yeah.
And other people that might upset the same kinds of people that were upset with me.
I think a bunch of TED fellows have resigned because of those invitations. Yeah.
Which might be a good thing.
Yeah.
But it's worth reiterating. Literally like high 90 percentile of the audience appeared to be totally fine. Whether or not they agreed with everything I said, they were not triggered, right? Like TED's audience is actually way more open to, I think, all of these ideas than they might be stereotyped by people unfamiliar. It's really the heckler's veto. It's a very small percentage of people that punch above their weight and ought to be ignored.
So where does DEI come into this? Mm. I'm not sure anyone listening to this podcast thinks the ideological capture of our institutions has been exaggerated anymore. I mean, we're now having this conversation in the aftermath of those disastrous hearings before Congress, where you had the presidents of Harvard and MIT and Penn unable to spell out what was wrong with advocating for genocide against the Jews, while having just merely weeks and months prior defenestrated people for not admiring DEI policies or admitting that there are only two biological sexes, etc. So we know that there's a fair amount of moral confusion in our universities, and that DEI has something to do with it. But it was up until that moment, it was still very common to hear that all this concern about wokeism or identitarian moral confusion or DEI overreach, all of this it's just pure Republican hyperbole, right? It's just not a problem. It's exaggerated. And I'm not detecting that anymore. So, I mean, perhaps you have a better sense of if there are any shades of skepticism on that point still remaining. What's your sense of what DEI has done? And do you think the pendulum is in the process of swinging back across all of our institutions? And now I'm thinking of, major corporations and universities and media properties. And where do you think it should swing back to?
Yeah, so the original idea and the benign idea of diversity, equity, and inclusion, the idea that, say, someone like my dad, a black man in corporate America, would have meant by DEI in, say, the 90s, is like, say you're a boss of a company who happens to be white and you have several people who report to you of different races, right? Don't just go out to lunch with the white guy. Like maybe, and it's more a point about cultural affinity than about race per se. It's you're likely to have more in common with the white guy, likely, not necessarily, but you could fall into the habit of simply doing what's familiar and not quite being fair to what's unfamiliar. And as a best practices in a corporation, you want to make sure that you're going to lunch with the woman that works for you as well, the black person that works for you as well, and giving people, you know, going beyond the default, right? Because the default might be a holding pattern that is in subtle ways exclusionary. I've got no problem with that. That seems like a very benign kind of best practices approach to having employees. What that morphs into is basically a strict regime of you need to have hired enough people of color, merit be damned, and God forbid you fire a person of color, that's highly likely to be a racial discrimination lawsuit. These are all things that do not make a work environment better. They make a work environment worse. And yet they are nowadays what people mean when they attack DEI. So I think, you know, if it can be restored to the kind of gentle, benign DEI of the past, then I'm for it. But in practice, it seems like what that becomes in most instances is the really toxic form of DEI, where you have to hire people, you have to hire a sufficient number of people of a certain race, or your institution is considered racist. And, you know, that sends the signal to the incoming people that their value to the company is synonymous with their racial identity, which then leads them to play up their race as the contributing factor, can set people up for failure if they were hired under lower standards than their peers. And you know, all of that, I think, you know, the fundamental part about it that's so confused is how little it has to do with the core problem of racial inequality and intergenerational poverty in this country. We spend so much time talking about affirmative action and DEI, and these are programs that really apply to 18-year-olds and above. These are adult fixations. They skip the years that are most malleable for children, where interventions have the most effect, and yet they are billed as addressing the legacy of slavery and racial inequality, when really they're primarily elites worrying about elite issues. And so in my book, I argue that besides a return to colorblindness by the elite, in our effort to, you know, shrink racial disparities in a healthy way, we should really be focusing on the basis of poverty towards interventions geared at younger ages, right? Between 0 and 18, you can have the biggest impact on a person's life. And we should be doing everything possible to implement what, for instance, Roland Fryer, the Harvard economist, did in Houston, where he randomly selected schools and just, he did a study where he could choose the principal, fire the principal, fire as many teachers as he wanted, change the curriculum. And he was able to raise math scores substantially among poor, mostly black and Hispanic students. And people can read about that study in the last chapter of my book if they're curious. But these are the kinds of interventions which are serious, which can be done on the basis of poverty rather than race, though that would disproportionately benefit black and Hispanic kids. Mm-hmm. And in the long run, I think within reason would lead to a shrinkage of some of the worst and widest disparities. And again, this is the core of the issue, not DEI, affirmative action, and so forth.
So in raising the issue of poverty, you're raising the issue of class in part, although the class differences amount to more than just pure economics. Let's just spell out this race versus class framing. I mean, my understanding, and I'm not quite sure when this started, but I remember the data I have in my head are probably 10 years old, but I remember Robert Putnam talking about how racial differences in America, if you control for class, are declining, have been declining, and class differences, if you control for race, have been increasing, right? So, which is to say that, you know, middle class or upper middle class, college educated, blacks and whites fare well and their outcomes are similar. And blacks and whites who drop out of high school and don't have a lot of money do badly and their outcomes are similar. And that is those similarities have been increasing. It's not to say there's zero racial difference when you control for class, but it's diminishing. So, and the widest differences obviously are a matter of social class. And it's not just a matter of poverty, although poverty is an enormous variable, but it's also a matter of everything that comes along with poverty or contributes to it, which, you know, all of the cultural norms that exist or unravel depending on a person's place across this class ladder, right? So the likelihood of being born into a single-parent household, right? You know, whether that's because of a very early divorce or it was an out-of-wedlock birth, right? That's a huge variable, and its importance is quite significant regardless of a person's race. Although the rate of out-of-wedlock birth and single-parent families is, I trust, still somewhat higher in the black community, but it's all too high among poor whites, right? So it's perhaps you're closer to those the more recent data here. But talk about class and these other variables like out-of-wedlock births and divorce.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's never just about your family income or your family wealth. It is that, but it's also that poverty is so often correlated with a set of social ills that are closer to the crux of the issue. If you grow up in a neighborhood with lots of crime, where the kind of natural role models of say, you know, men 10 years older than you, you know, crime is a fairly common career, well, then it becomes a lot harder for you to resist crime as a career than it was for me having grown up in Montclair, New Jersey. That's a problem that is highly correlated with poverty, but actually not the same, because there are some poor communities where there's actually very little crime, right? The economist Raj Chetty did a really landmark study at this point, probably 6 or so years ago, where he found that the gap conditional on parental income between black girls and white girls had closed, which is to say, a black girl born poor and a white girl born equally poor will grow up on average to make the same amount of money. But a black boy born poor will grow up to earn far less than a white boy born similarly poor. So that the social mobility gap was entirely a problem of black boys as opposed to black girls. The other thing he found there, you bring up single parent homes, he found the very interesting result that actually being in a single parent home itself was not so much correlated with all of these bad outcomes as being in a neighborhood where the vast majority of people are from single parent homes. The implications of these are complicated and interesting. For instance, if it were a mere matter of racial discrimination, you wouldn't expect to find such a big gap between boys and girls, and you wouldn't expect the social mobility gap among girls to have closed. And if it were a mere issue of parenting inside the household, it'd be sort of hard to understand why the neighborhood effect is so much stronger than the home effect. These are very difficult issues. My argument is that the levers we have to pull at the level of policy. You know, the biggest ones are the policy towards crime and crime reduction and education. You can't really reach into somebody's home and make them parent their children differently. You can't make someone's husband come back if he's an inveterate gambler and a drunk. But what we can do is vote for evidence-based policies that make rigorous education available to poor kids in the Roland Fryer style, and policies that prioritize cleaning up crime, because I'm not sure there's anything worse for a kid than to grow up in a neighborhood rife with crime, both from a stress perspective and from a role model perspective. And I think all of that can be done, if not on the basis of class narrowly construed, then on the basis of, you know, where are these social ills prevalent? There are, you know, areas in Appalachia where you have whole communities hostage to fentanyl overdose and drug-related crime and so forth, and you'll hardly find a person of color amongst the people. And so on that basis, we do have an obligation to do our best to use the resources of the government to help people. And that's the crux of the issue. We spend very little time actually talking about that. Most of the conversation is absorbed with sort of, frankly, I think elites, a lot of elites of color who have a self-interest in preserving race-based policies because it benefits us to some degree. And I think we should be honest about that.
So let's take the crime piece, right? So I'm imagining, although I think with a high order of confidence, a progressive or far left reaction to this idea that the first order of business, or among the first, is to deal with the radical disparity in crime across various communities, and this highly correlates with race. I mean, as you pointed out, if we could get rid of all the Black and Hispanic shootings in New York, we would have brought the shooting rate, I'm sure that's pretty close to the murder rate, down by 95%, right? So the problem of gun crime in New York is not a problem of in the white community, or at least 95% of it isn't. Politically, that is a fairly radioactive thing to notice. And to respond to that difference with a disparity in how one polices a society is going to immediately throw up accusations of racist policing, right? Even if done by Black cops or Hispanic cops, I mean, it's still going to, the optics are awful. And we can still hear the deranging echoes of the phrase defund the police, which amazingly got spoken in earnest at some point in the aftermath of George Floyd. What do you do with that? I mean, it is commonsensical that if murderers are walking the sidewalks of your neighborhood unarrested and not at all likely to be arrested, that that's going to produce a host of bad outcomes for any child brought up in that neighborhood. And so it just seems obvious that you have to solve violent crime where it is occurring. And if it's occurring in inner city Chicago, disproportionately as it is, well, then you have to go there to solve those crimes. What do you do with the predictable far left reaction to all this?
Yeah. Well, I think that it's useful to look at recent history. In the early 90s, the murder rate in New York was close to 10 times what it was 25 years later. There was stop and frisk at points during that 25 years, but certainly not during all of it. And it seemed that for whatever reason, crime had a way of sort of coming down without the police doing any kind of El Salvador style rounding up of everyone without due process until, and most American cities had the same story since the early 90s, until 2020 came. Defund the police happened in certain cities as more than rhetoric, but as policy. A mass retirement of police officers due to bad morale happened. And we had, according to Pew, the biggest year-over-year increase in the homicide rate in the past 100 years. In my view, avoiding the worst policies is half the battle. So really, really fighting the progressive, soft-on-crime policies that reliably lead to increases in the homicide rate is half the battle. Those policies are extremely seductive because it's impossible to watch a George Floyd-type video and not have the reaction, what the hell is wrong with these police officers? You can put as much context behind it. You can understand, and you know, and I've done as deep a dive as anyone into the reasons to think Chauvin may have been innocent. But at an emotional level, it's impossible to watch things like that and not react in a certain way. And in the age of social media and smartphones, we're continually getting more and more of those kind of inputs, even though the reality on the ground has gotten better over the past 30 years. So somehow resisting the urge towards policies that allow the crime rate to increase suddenly, that is half the battle. And on the other side, you don't want to go too far. I think in the eyes of many people, stop and frisk was too far because you had so many Black and Hispanic kids, that the majority of whom were doing nothing wrong, had been thrown up against a wall twice by the time they're 18. And you know, there are trade-offs on both sides. But ultimately, I think it's extremely important to resist the worst policies and hopefully observe year over year incremental progress the way that most American cities did between, say, 1990 and 2019.
Well, I don't know if we want to touch the topic of Derek Chauvin and George Floyd, talk about radioactive.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's just so inconvenient that the examples of consequential racism in so many cases that produce this outsized reaction, just explosions of outrage and riots and primetime news anchors talking about, you know, mostly peaceful protests as images of burning buildings light up the screen. It is deeply inconvenient that almost without exception, I mean, there are some exceptions, but so many of these instances don't survive scrutiny, right? I mean, it's just, the most extreme case was something like the Jussie Smollett hoax, right? Where it's just, you know, you have somebody for whatever deranged reason faking a racist hate crime and pretending to have been the victim of one. But I mean, even in this case where it's one of the most witnessed horrors in human history, I mean, everyone saw that video of Derek Chauvin kneeling on George Floyd's neck and apparently murdering him as an expression of his own racism. Nobody really saw what they thought they saw there. And yet it's just toxic to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah, I encourage anyone interested to look at my piece in the Free Press for a detailed dive on the many aspects of that case that were not what they appeared to everyone at first. You know, like everyone, I saw that video. I think, you know, we all had the same reaction, just absolute horror. You're watching a man slowly die and slowly, what looks like slowly be killed with a knee on his neck as everyone around them, you know, as he cries for his mother and so forth. One thing that I've been saying this for years, but, and I think you've said this as well, for every one of these videos, there is a white equivalent. And in the case of George Floyd, it was Tony Timpa who died a few years prior in a very similar way, except he was knelt on for 13 minutes and the officers were cracking jokes as he lost consciousness.
Yeah.
And that's the one piece of media bias to put at the top, is just you're not seeing all the examples of white people being killed in very similar situations, which creates the impression that these kinds of things only happen to Black people. And that leads to riots and tapping into the kind of deep feelings that Americans have about racial inequality. And then, you know, if you want the deeper dive into the specifics of George Floyd and Chauvin, I would go to my Free Press piece. But the short version is that there are really three elements that weren't what they seemed from the initial clip and the reporting. One was this idea that Chauvin's knee on the neck or upper back, that hold was Chauvin's quote-unquote signature move, as some outlets reported, that this was some hold that Chauvin used uniquely and was a badge of his unique cruelty. In reality, it was a trained technique called the maximal restraint technique. It was a part of their training, which immediately throws into reasonable doubt whether it was a felony. Because if it was an officer, even if he contributed to someone's death by doing exactly what he was trained to do, or something very similar to what he was trained to do, that may throw into doubt for a jury whether a felony was committed. And ultimately, Chauvin's most serious charge was felony murder, which requires at least an attempted felony. So that's the first aspect that most people don't know. And in fact, several people testified at trial, allowing the jury to come to the conclusion that what Chauvin did had nothing to do with training, which the balance of evidence at this point really indicates the opposite. The second issue was, of course, the autopsy. What was reported was that two autopsies were performed, one by the official county examiner and one by the family. And what many outlets reported was that basically both the autopsies differed in some details, but they both ruled it a homicide. In reality, when you dig into it, the second autopsy was they didn't even have access, according to the New York Times, to some of the bodily tissues and some of the organs. And it was performed by this guy, Michael Bodden, who was has a history of opportunism going back to the OJ trial, where he advanced the outlandish multiple attacker theory and so forth. And as it happens, he's also the guy that said Jeffrey Epstein's wounds were not consistent with suicide. So take that for whatever it's worth. But when you look at the only real autopsy that was done, the only autopsy for which a report was produced with detailed access and detailed descriptions of the body, it found that the cause of death was cardiopulmonary arrest, which is to say the heart and lungs stop working, complicating officer subdual and neck restraint. And complicating in that case means occurring at the same time as. It also found that he had an amount of fentanyl in his blood, which is potentially lethal, though not definitely lethal, as well as smaller amounts of morphine and methamphetamine. And it found, importantly, it found no life-threatening injuries whatsoever. No injuries to the neck or to the trachea that would suggest the proximate cause of death was the knee on the neck. Now, that can just seem, frankly, at odds with the video, because the video, it just does look like Chauvin is putting his weight on his neck in a way that might cause anyone to die. But the only actual medical evidence is not consistent with that as the cause of death. So if you think of all of this from the anchor of reasonable doubt, which is not the normal way human beings think about stuff, in a courtroom, reasonable doubt means there are only unreasonable ways to think that the defendant might be innocent. In this case, I think on both fronts, the training and the autopsy, there were probably reasonable ways of thinking that Chauvin might have been innocent. And I think that's what most people didn't get in their initial download of the facts of that case.
Well, just the one piece you flagged at the beginning, the fact that this knee on the neck procedure was indeed a procedure that they had been trained to use under certain circumstances, one could question whether it was legitimate to use it under those circumstances with Floyd already cuffed, etc. But the idea that this is something that they've been trained on and it's not this insane, sadistic aberration that Chauvin invented, that's an enormous piece of information that virtually no one had just watching the video. I mean, it's just,
And it's incredibly relevant to what charges might be brought against him. So I'm not in any way implying that no charges ought to have been brought against him, but the truth is the jury was not permitted to see the training photos of officers doing that hold, right? There's a training slide in which an officer is it's almost indistinguishable from what Chauvin is doing to Floyd. And this was on a PowerPoint training slide for Minneapolis police officers. That was excluded from evidence. The judge allowed that to be excluded from evidence. So the question is, you know,
do you know anything more about why that was justified? I mean, it seems...
I do. Yeah. So and this is from Chauvin's defense's appeal, which was rejected. Apparently, according to that, the prosecution moved to exclude it because Chauvin could not prove that he attended the specific training at which that specific slide was shown.
Oh my God, that is Kafkaesque.
Yeah. I think I've talked to people that have gone to law school, and they say, you know, when I was in law school, I was taught as progressive policy that someone on trial for murder should get to show any legally obtained evidence that isn't prima facie absurd, right? It can't be on its face absurd that there is a slide showing the exact hold Chauvin has Floyd in, and somehow Chauvin wasn't influenced by that. It's like whether or not he saw that picture, or that was just a picture of what was trained every year, that was just an example picture. Clearly, it's helpful for the jury to know that this picture exists, right? Because automatically that puts his alleged crime in a potentially different category, maybe negligence, maybe something else, maybe something serious, not second degree felony murder. So I think that's a piece that has been very uncomfortable to talk about, but is important.
Mm. Well, what would you expect to happen? And I think I asked this question somewhat cynically and rhetorically, if Chauvin prevailed on appeal and was let out of prison.
My understanding now is that he is out of appeals, and his only resource is pleading ineffective assistance of counsel. That's what I've been told. But to entertain the hypothetical, if he were released from prison, if he were somehow pardoned of every crime, both federal and state, there's a pretty good chance that the city of Minneapolis would go up in flames, at least if it were summertime and people had the ability to riot.
Could get a fire started.
Yeah, exactly. But however much that is true today, it was doubly and triply true at the time the trial occurred. At the time the trial occurred, it was in almost everyone's mind that if he were acquitted, somebody would pay. Either local businesses or people involved with the trial might be subject to violence. And this is not simply my speculation. You can read in my free press piece, I quote jurors, actual jurors on the trial and potential jurors that are quoted fearing for the verdict coming out one way or the other. And so this is a scenario in which a fair trial, the jury also wasn't sequestered, a fair trial uninfluenced by massive public pressure, that is precisely the opposite of what happened. There was enormous pressure. Lots of people had a stake in a guilty verdict. And I always hesitate to judge people because I don't know how I would act in certain situations. When, if you live in a city that has been through the trauma that Minneapolis went through in a mere few days, what Minneapolis went through in 2020 was absolutely devastating. It's very tempting in that situation to suspend reason, sort of consciously or not, to save your city. And I think that is what went through a lot of people's heads.
Yeah, but that's the very nature of what it is to be a scapegoat in that case. I mean, it's interesting just to consider the optics of this topic of our conversation, right? I mean, this is something that I would never be tempted to focus on because it's just, I guess I would be filtering against a sort of pick your battles schema here, which is like, there's just no, like the idea that I'm going to do a podcast in defense of Derek Chauvin, it's just, it's going to ring so many alarms, you know, it's like, you know, I should invite Charles Murray back on to do it with me.
Right.
You know, it's just, it's like, it would be bonkers to do. And even for you, you know, the black guy focusing on this, you don't get away scot-free. I mean, this is a very sort of Candace Owens kind of clickbait topic, right? It's just like, there's something unseemly about even wanting to look at the autopsy report to find the fentanyl in George Floyd's blood. It's just, why go there? There's an ick factor to all of this, but the reason why it's worth doing, the reason why it's worth talking about this and worrying about this is just to observe how corrosive and dangerous it is for the justice system to be, in this case, the justice system, you know, the other institutions can be bent in the same way. The justice system responding to this perception of mob violence that is in the offing, right? I mean, that's the nullification of more or less everything we can rely upon in a civilized society, right? It's like, so on the other side of the aisle, this has occurred with Republican politicians who defend Trump in public and in private have expressed their concern that if they don't defend him, you know, if they were to sign on to his impeachment after January 6th, say, or fail to defend him now, they're actually worried that the Trumpist mob will come for them and their families. They're literally worried about violence. There are mm-hmm. senators and congresspeople who have, behind closed doors, admitted to Mitt Romney and Liz Cheney that they're afraid for the lives of their families due to this perceived threat of, you know, doxing and assassination in this case, right? Different mob aimed in the opposite direction politically, and it's just as nullifying of everything we should care about in a civilized society. So it's bad to cave into this at all. And, you know, while you say it's understandable, it is, but it's just, we need to hold the line here somehow. And yet I don't know what to do about the ick factor. I mean, well, you know, I guess what we're doing tacitly is just ramming through it and having the conversation, but
Let's put it this way. If you can't tell the difference between a person that believes the CIA invented Hollywood, as Candace Owens recently said, and someone like me, then I'm not sure I can help you. But we have to be able to make distinctions between people that reach for the conspiracy as an instinct every time immediately and happen to get it right, the proverbial broken clock that is right twice a day, and the people that are trying their best to stick to the best available evidence, however imperfectly.
Yeah. Although, again, there are gradations of this capture by partisanship and ideology that really effectively smear everyone or almost anyone by association. So, like, I can build a bridge from you to Candace Owens through Christopher Rufo, right? Who I think is, you guys are, you're both at the Manhattan Institute?
I was at the Manhattan Institute a few years ago.
Right. So I don't know Christopher.
But I've had him on my podcast, I think twice.
Yeah. So, and obviously he's been super effective in his own orbit, but I do view it's a somewhat untutored impression of him and his work, but I view him as Candace Owens adjacent. I mean, he's Coleman Hughes adjacent, but he's also Candace Owens adjacent in how one note his political and ethical concerns seem to be, right? It's all about pure, he considers himself a journalist in certain hours of the day, but he is an activist in every hour of the day, going hard against critical race theory and trans ideology. I'm not sure how he would describe all of that, but he's riding shotgun with Candace or she with him so much of the time. I certainly don't have the sense that I can rely on him to be intellectually honest across the board on these issues or, you know, acknowledge the Trumpist horror show that is, you know, standing at his back. And so it's hard because these political emergencies make strange bedfellows, and we're all vulnerable to being wrapped up in the same sentence with someone who we agree with on points X, Y, and Z. And then when they reveal themselves to be a complete crackpot on some other point, we're, you know, worrying about Jewish space lasers or whatever it is. It seems to discredit every previous conversation we've had on these topics.
Yeah. Insofar as I understand, you know, the difference between someone like myself and the people that are sort of on the right formally, is that I don't consider myself a single issue voter. In other words, you could find, you know, despite being the guy at this point that literally wrote the book about colorblindness, if I saw a greater threat from the right, I would subordinate my position on colorblindness to that. Because despite the fact that my book is about a single issue, as a person, I try to weigh all the issues. You know, like I don't want a president that is a wild card and tweets at the dictator of North Korea, and you know, this kind of thing bothers me enough that if he agrees with me on colorblindness, I'd rather acknowledge that and say, thank you, next, I will be voting for your opponent. And that's why I voted for Hillary and Biden. So I guess it's strange because any person that is a single issue voter on, say, race policy, in other words, they're pro-colorblindness against racial policy, they're going to like my book. They're going to like me most of the time. But they might be one of the reply guys on Twitter that's constantly reminding me that I voted for Biden, who supports some of the very policies that I oppose in my book. This isn't a contradiction to me, but it is a contradiction to some. And that may capture, I think, insofar as there's a difference between someone like me and, I don't want to say Rufo, because I actually don't, you know, I don't follow him closely enough to know exactly that I'm being fair, but certainly someone like Candace.
Mm. Is there any daylight between you and John McWhorter or Glenn Lowry on these issues? I know you have spoken with both of them a lot, as I've spoken with both of them some, certainly, on this podcast and elsewhere. Where do you guys line up, just across the board, or are there interesting disagreements?
It's a good question. I mean, I know John and Glenn often disagree about Trump, but if we put that to the side and talk about race issues, colorblindness, and so forth, I find myself almost all the time in agreement with their basic position. Now, John has definitely not emphasized colorblindness to the degree I have, and has emphasized, I think, some discomfort with the word, though I suspect if we drill down to meanings, there would not be that much daylight on the end goal or on what I mean by colorblindness. So I think broadly, both of them, I've heard express the thesis of my book in different words, that ultimately we have to anchor ourselves to the idea that race is not a meaningful trait, and that should be our North Star with respect to race issues in general.
What about the topic of reparations? How can we dispatch that in a few minutes? Because on its face, if you just say, you take the variable of wealth inequality, last I looked, I think there was an 8-to-1 difference in the amount of wealth that you know, white and black families hold, you know, per capita in America on average. I think that's still, you know, more or less true. It seems trivially easy to allege that there are historical reasons, at least in part, for that difference, and that the difference matters, and that one way of addressing it is to simply transfer, a one-time transfer of wealth would reset the starting line of the equal opportunity race that we have before us. What's wrong with the concept of reparations? I should remind people that Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote an article in The Atlantic that was much celebrated. I don't know how many years ago that was, in favor of reparations. What are your intuitions about it?
So despite being one of the more public, quote unquote, opponents of reparations, I've actually always supported reparations paid to living victims of the Jim Crow system. In other words, if you know, you can show that in 1963 you were denied a mortgage in a redlined neighborhood, then I think it makes sense for the government to try to make you whole, at least in principle. And there have been programs like that in a suburb outside of Chicago, for instance. When you're talking about now reparations for slavery, which ended in 1865, I don't think that you can make the confident claim that 150 years hence, slavery is the proximate cause of the wealth gap. Now, the brilliance of Ta-Nehisi Coates' article is that it doesn't argue that. It actually makes a pretty narrow argument based on the fact that many Black Americans missed out on the post-World War II enormous real estate boom, weren't able to get into suburban homes cheap in the 1950s, and weren't able to enjoy the enormous gains that many people who did get into the real estate market at that time did. To the extent those people are still alive, I support those programs. I don't support what I view as a kind of social science fiction that we know what the effects of events in 1860 were on us today. I think I make a distinction between those two. And the other point about this, I think it misses two important points. The first is that when you look at the whole landscape of disparities, rather than the single data point of African Americans, it's impossible to come to the conclusion that the main driver of disparities is historical or present discrimination. Because if that were true, it would predict a set of disparities that we don't in fact see. What we in fact see is that both between races and within races especially, you see ethnic groups at the top and the bottom of most relevant metrics. So you see Nigerian Americans doing better than average, Haitian Americans doing much worse when you and I couldn't tell the difference between a Nigerian and a Haitian to discriminate. You see Indian Americans at the very top, Bangladeshi Americans at the bottom. The same point applies. You see the same thing within Asian American groups. You see the same thing if you compare, say, Irish Americans to Jewish Americans. And so if discrimination past and present were the main driver of such disparities, you wouldn't expect to see groups which face the same amount of discrimination, you know, at such disparate ends of the measure. So that's point one. And then the second point is there is a psychology with reparations which is perverse. Namely, what is demanded before it happens is quite often taken for granted after it happens. I can give a few examples. One is the election of Obama. If you go back to 2005 or 6, I think everyone I know would have said, nope, the nation is too racist to elect a black man named Barack Hussein Obama. That's a prediction based on the model of the country. When that prediction was falsified, a rational person would have updated their model and said, well, actually, we're not too racist to elect a black man named Barack Hussein Obama. But that's not what happened. What you got was instead a flurry of elites reminding you that actually, even though we thought it was super meaningful 2 seconds ago, it's not meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
And that was essentially pocketed.
With a token president.
Yeah, exactly. I remember reading an article before Juneteenth was a federal holiday arguing that it should be. I agreed with the article because I think there's what better to celebrate than the end of slavery as a momentous occasion in American history? What better reason for a federal holiday could there be? But the article said that it's going to be really, really hard to get this, presumably because there's so much resistance to historical soul searching. Next thing you know, it breezes through Congress with almost no resistance, and probably in a decade, if not already, no one will even remember that it was considered a stretch. This is what happens. The normal dynamic when someone seeks an apology is they actually want it. But there are circumstances where the power to keep demanding the apology is more important than the apology itself. And that in a nutshell is the psychology of reparations. Mm-hmm. You know, there have been both houses of Congress have apologized for slavery formally in around 2008. 2004, the Senate apologized for lynching. At least 9 different states, southern states in particular, have independently apologized for slavery. No one even remembers it because the things that are demanded in prospect are forgotten in retrospect, and I'm quite sure that would happen with reparations too.
Mm. Yeah, you reminded me of something John McWhorter said on this topic, which struck me as very likely and also depressing, which is that even if we circumvented all of the obstacles to reparations, we figured out exactly who should get the money and exactly how much, and there were no, you know, perverse incentives, there was nothing wrong with it at all, right? We just executed it perfectly. And of course, this is a cartoon. Even in that case, what you would have, people would immediately pivot and say, the activist class would immediately pivot and say, don't think you can just buy us off with one check. You think just some money is going to actually correct for all of the racism in the society? Mm-hmm. And it's that pivot that is made a mockery of the whole project, at least to hear John describe it in that case. I'm sure he has more to say on the topic. But I did, that was something I hadn't really foreseen. And it does strike me as very likely. It would somehow be viewed as a kind of moral sacrilege on the activist side to think that it's a desecration of the project morally to think that it has a simple price tag.
Mm-hmm.
You mean to say that you think $1 trillion really cancels the problem of the crime of slavery? Mm-hmm. What sort of monster are you, right? This is about much more than money.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And I recommend everyone go back and read Martin Luther King's book, Why We Can't Wait. He has a whole passage where he talks about the legacy of slavery, the need to do something special to essentially pay back what he would have called the Negro at that point. And then he lays out his plan, which he called the Bill of Rights for the Disadvantaged. It was a class-based anti-poverty program meant to benefit the black and white poor alike, but disproportionately to benefit the black as a result of the existing disparities. Mm. But this was his plan, and it was aimed at addressing the legacy of slavery. And nowadays, it doesn't sound like it fits that hole because it doesn't select for race explicitly. But I think there was a deep wisdom in that approach, which I think we should rediscover.
Well, I will also remind people there's another book they can read out probably just a few days before this podcast drops. That is The End of Race Politics, Arguments for a Colorblind America, written by the still young Coleman Hughes.
Not for much longer.
How old are you, Coleman?
27 now.
Nice. Well, that is still young. That's a good age to be. Coleman, thanks again for your time. It's always great talking to you.
Thanks, Sam.